Life with Suzanne Hill
on ABC Radio.
Nightlife is, when was the last time you had a big night out? I'm not talking about just catching up over a few drinks at the pub. I mean a really big night out. You know, getting dressed up, meeting friends, going out to a party, going dancing, maybe kicking on to a club or an after party. You know, the sort of nights that you'll talk about years later and tell your kids and grandkids about to make them believe that you were once cool. What we get up to between dusk and dawn is not only about making personal memories. Nightlife has sparked new creative and cultural inventions like jazz and disco. Well, our guest tonight, Imogen Willits, she has a great title. She's a party historian, and she reckons that we have a lot to be grateful for when it comes to nighttime activities and the night itself. Imogen's written a book called Up All Night. She's chronicled some of the biggest party scenes in history, from the Pleasure Gardens of London to Studio 54 and up to the 2000s Hollywood celebrity gatherings. She's joining me now on Nightlife to take a look back at some of humanity's wildest and most hedonistic party days. Hello, Imogen. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, now, do you have one of these nights in your own life, you know, that you can talk about, or do you look at all this historical partying with a little bit of envy?
Well, yeah, there is a little bit of that. I mean, writing a book, you do have to be a little bit of a social hermit. And so there were definitely times where I was like, it's like writing a recipe book and living on gruel. I was like, I'm writing about all these incredible things, but I'm not kind of experiencing them properly. But I think as I get older, you know, I'm in my late 30s now. I still love to go out. But for me, it's about quality, not quantity. So there might be a few, you know, big nights out a year that we do with this group of friends, but it's certainly not something every Friday, Saturday, perhaps when I was younger. You know, it changes as you get older, but going out is still very, very important.
So what is it, do you think, Imogen, about coming together to enjoy ourselves that is so essential to life?
Well, there's this amazing expression coined by the sociologist Emil Durkheim in the 1910s. So referring to that sort of prickly sense of euphoria that we feel in peak communal experiences, whether that's at, you know, a football stadium or it's at a festival or a nightclub or whatever it might be, that surge of euphoria is called collective effervescence. And it describes the sensation of feeling part of something bigger than yourself. And I think that that experience is so fundamental to what it is to be human. Of course, something that you can experience through religion or religious worship as well. But in a secular or an atheist society, nightlife is a really, really important means to experience that important sensation. So collective effervescence, that surge of euphoria has a name.
But why is that the darkness and the fact that these kinds of gatherings can happen at night so important to creating that collective effervescence?
Yeah, well, there's something that's so important about the sense of anonymity and transgression that comes from darkness. I think we can all sort of instinctively feel that the normal rules of society perhaps, you know, don't apply in the exact same way. We associate daytime, daylight with work, and you need a different kind of environment to truly let loose. So yes, the dark is very, very important. That sense of transgression, the sense of anonymity, maybe being able to, you know, be someone else that's different to your daytime working self.
Imogen Willits is here. She's the author of Up All Night. We're calling her a party historian. Is that how you describe yourself, Imogen?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think if you're writing a book about the history of nightlife, I mean, if the shoe fits.
What a great title. Hi, I'm Imogen. I'm a party historian. This is Our Nightlife with Suzanne Hill. Nightlife is, I don't know if you're having a wild time full of collective effervescence right now while listening to the radio, but look, we will do our best to try to take you there. Now, Imogen, your history of the big night out starts in 17th century Japan. Why did you start there?
Well, you know, I think the important thing to think about when we chart the beginning of nightlife is the experiences that we associate with nightlife, drinking, dancing, hedonism, have been around for hundreds of thousands of years. But those experiences were contained within religion, because religion was an all-encompassing kind of structure. I mean, there's even evidence, as I talk about in the book, that going to church in medieval England was actually a pretty hedonistic thing. You know, people were dancing and having all these wild carnivals and feasts. And there's one theory that pews were introduced into Wells Cathedral to subdue the dancing. So in a sense, it takes us a long time to get to nightlife as its own separate entity, away from religion, away from court and court banquets, because you sort of didn't need it for a very long time, because religion contained that hedonistic kind of instinct. And then the really important thing that happens in Japan is in autumn 1657, Yoshiwara, which were the pleasure gardens on the outskirts of Edo, the city which is now Tokyo, and they were given permission to stay open all night. And that was a privilege granted to no other place of public entertainment. There were strict curfews that operated everywhere else in the city. You know, we're basically talking kind of military dictatorship here. And Yoshiwara was completely unique in an environment designed for the night. It was separate to the court. It was not about religion. It was just about partying. And we can say that that's the beginning of modern nightlife.
Now, who would go to Yoshiwara? What would they do there?
So Yoshiwara was for the men of Edo. So Edo was a completely male-dominated city. So you had the samurai and you had these newly, you know, increasing merchants who were getting increasingly wealthy. You know, domestic trade was booming. And so the merchants were accruing all of this money, but were actually very limited in how they could spend it because, again, we're in a very, very restricted society. They couldn't buy up big estates and properties and all this sort of thing. And so Yoshiwara actually provided this very important outlet for sort of conspicuous consumption, competitiveness between these two groups of men, the samurai and the merchants. And it was a very, very flashy place. You know, the average night out in Yoshiwara would cost the equivalent of something like $10,000 a day. So we're really thinking the most elite Las Vegas flashy style clubs. You know, that's what Yoshiwara was all about. And it was a place where men in Edo could, you know, bask in a more female dominated environment. You know, Edo as the city would have felt very militarized, whereas Yoshiwara was kind of artistic, cultural, soft pink lighting, these incredible courtesans with their fashion, kimonos, makeup, amazing hair, you know. So it was a kind of female escapist place for the men of Edo.
Now, is this right that a night out could cost the equivalent of about $10,000 in today's money?
Yeah, exactly that. So very expensive, very flashy. And people would get into, I mean, the men would get into insane levels of debt. And so if you were accruing up debts with, you know, a tea house or a brothel or something, the system that they created was that they would basically imprison the man underneath a bathtub. And then someone from Yoshiwara would then release them and then follow them around as they went about their daily life and just help themselves to possessions of value until the debt had been kind of nulled. So wasn't the best system, but yeah, it was incredibly expensive, flashy, and it was a place of showing off wealth and conspicuous consumption.
Okay, so that's one of our first big all-night party locations in what
exactly
is now Tokyo. It did burn down a couple of times, didn't it? But it kept getting rebuilt, so that certainly says there was plenty of demand, wasn't there?
Yes. So it shows the demand, but I think it also shows something really important to the story of nightlife, which is how dangerous it was before electricity. So, you know, high density nightlife environments that would have been lit only by candles, and Yoshiwara, it was, you know, built of wood, paper, and they had all these paper lanterns. It looked completely exquisite and bewitching by night, but there's a lot of danger to that as well. And I think it's a reminder of exactly these high-density nightlife environments when you're relying on candlelight, very, very dangerous.
I suppose there's nothing left of Yoshiwara?
No, there isn't. So I walked around the streets, and the streets in modern-day Tokyo have retained that same grid layout, but nothing of Yoshiwara exists today, unfortunately. But there are some amazing, if anyone's interested, the 18th century, 17th century woodblock prints of that time made by the Japanese artists. There are a lot of those which document nights out in Yoshiwara. So you get a sense of it from the art that was made at the time.
We're talking about some of the biggest nights out in history. I've got Imogen Willards here, who is a party historian. Her book is called Up All Night and Nightlifers, Don't You Love It? That we're talking about nightlife on nightlife. So I think that's very meta or something. Now, next image, and let's go visit London's pleasure gardens. What could a visitor to one of these events expect?
God, so yeah, Vauxhall Gardens, I have to say, I think it puts our modern nightlife completely to shame. I mean, these were extraordinary spaces of which there's no real modern comparison. So Vauxhall Gardens, this 12-acre night garden on the outskirts of London, open all night, lit up with amazing kind of coloured candlelight that at the time was something that no one had ever seen before. No electricity, so instead you were dancing to like pumping organ music. There was an enormous organ right in the centre of the garden. And one of the, I think, kind of amazing things to think about that people were doing in the 17th century, there's this big trend for volcanomania. So Pompeii was starting to be excavated in the 1740s, and people in Britain became obsessed by this idea of volcanic destruction. And I think what it represented was a sort of godless apocalypse. It's the sense of kind of an apocalyptic event that has nothing to do with religion, and it was just this natural disaster. So you would go to Vauxhall and watch these insane, like, pyrotechnic shows of volcanic eruptions. They would build mock Pompeii's that they would destroy with like fire and pyrotechnics. There would be fireworks. So these shows, these volcanic eruption shows, sort of like the summer blockbusters of their time, you know, their equivalent of going to a Christopher Nolan film. And you would be watching these in a crowd of sort of 10,000 people. You know, these are huge, huge events.
Imogen, I remember just thinking a few months ago, you know, I must have been like singing loudly to a particular rock song and thinking, gosh, I'm sorry that people a few hundred years ago never got to have the experience of, you know, disco and rock and that kind of music that really grabs you. But do you imagine actually that the pumping organ music, it would have actually done the same kind of thing, created the same kind of experience?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it is interesting. I think that actually some of those experiences would have been very similar to experiencing a DJ set at a festival, because they talk about in some of the literature about Vauxhall, the organ player would include things like, you know, novelty sound effects. You know, it was very much about like keeping things fun for the crowd. So there'd be things like birdsong might sort of come in at a certain moment. I do think that organ music at Vauxhall would have been, yeah, akin to some kind of crazy festival experience that we have now, and very booming and, yeah, deep, deep, like big music being experienced by a big crowd of people in a muddy garden. You know, it's Glastonbury.
Now, Imogen, I've spent a lot of time watching period dramas, you know, set in sort of the 1800s. I often notice, you know, when they have the big party in someone's ballroom, it seems to go all night. Do you think that was common at the time too?
Yes, I think that sometimes there's this perception that people in the past were quite buttoned up. Mm. But the party scene, yeah, in Vauxhall, and again in the kind of balls that we see in Jane Austen kind of style period dramas, that yeah, there was a very different attitude to the night. And I think also because they didn't have the working hours that we now have, you know, before industrialization, there just was a sense of, you know, things just went on all night. You know, Vauxhall was open till 6, 7 a.m. And there are some, you know, amazing stories that you can see in some of the newspapers at the time of, you know, priests going to work the next day and seeming hungover because they might have been at Vauxhall the night before. You know, it really was something that captured the whole city. And yeah, people were partying all night long.
So from all the party scenes that you researched, is there a place and a time that you wish you could go back to and experience the nightlife for yourself? If you could have one big night out in the past, Imogen, where would you go?
I think as someone who's, you know, born and raised in London, I think I just have so much curiosity about the pleasure garden scene. And I think because it's so different to the nightlife that we have today, I would love to go back and watch a full-on volcanic eruption show with 10,000 people in Georgian London, 100%.
Yeah, I would love to feel how excited you could actually get by that. Now, I'm sure many people's answer to that question might be Weimar era in Berlin, where we might think hedonistic nights, cabaret, excess. You actually think it might not have been all that it's cracked up to be. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so I think there's more kind of nuance there when we think about Weimar Berlin, because I think it's tempting. There's this phrase that's used a lot, dancing on the edge of a volcano. And I think that we absorb this sort of myth of this very, very hedonistic city that was too caught up in partying to notice or potentially even to stop or challenge the devastating kind of political upheavals that were happening all around it with the rise of Nazism and Hitler. And I think that in the West, I think we've absorbed a lot of the sort of Christopher Isherwood depiction, you know, the whose memoir was then eventually turned into Cabaret. And he's a British writer. He got to Berlin in 1929, so he only caught the tail end of the era. And, you know, 10 years existed, you know, happened before he arrived. And I think that when, you know, I was going into the research for this chapter and reading different kind of travel guides and things like that, the thing that really struck me was that the most hedonistic, wild, shocking, crazy cabarets were basically selling shock to the tourist market. So, you know, the really, really wild places would often just be filled with rich American and British businessmen who came to Berlin to be shocked by this wild kind of decadent city, and the city kind of sold it back to them. And then the reality of some of the queer night spots, I mean, yes, of course there were fetish clubs and all these kinds of things going on, but for a lot of the queer clubs, they were actually quite genteel. You know, it was sort of riffing on ballroom dances, and there was a lesbian organization that, you know, was arranging sort of picnics, and, you know, it was very sort of twee and middle class. And so I think that when we imagine this hedonistic era, we've got to remember that there was a bit of market pragmatism going on there as well, that they were selling something that was exactly what tourists wanted to see.
I love that idea of tourists seeking authenticity, and then, you know, the tourist providers basically giving them exactly what they wanted, but kind of ruining the authenticity in the process was happening back then,
exactly.
as well as
exactly
as it is now.
Yeah.
All right. Shall we jump to the dance floor, Imogen, and have a bit of a dance? I'm sure some of our listeners would have been hitting the dance floor in the 70s. How did disco go from an underground movement to taking over clubs?
Yeah. So disco, I mean, the interesting thing about disco is, again, you know, starts with these, you know, in New York, Chicago, these amazing kind of gay, straight, interracial nightclubs like Paradise Garage and David Mancuso's Love Saves the Day. You know, this is like a loft party that he ran in 1970. And it was all very kind of eclectic style of music. You know, you would be dropping in samples from all of these different genres, and it was again to kind of like keep the dance floor like euphoric and buzzing. And then, you know, again, it's this kind of classic tale of commercialization, that as record labels got kind of increasingly interested in this scene and wanted to sell it, the disco music that was then kind of pumped out towards the end of the 70s was, you know, a completely different thing. It was its own genre that the detractors of disco would say was actually just very kind of monotonous and quite samey. But that's very different to how it began. It began as these very eclectic, wild, creative DJ sets. And the music industry was so excited by disco because they thought, finally, we have found a recession-proof genre of music that will just sell, you know, cheaper, you know, to do a disco record than a big band, like a big rock band. Cheaper to have a DJ play at a club than it is to have a big rock band. So there's a lot of kind of capitalism, you know, wrapped up in the story of disco. And then once you get to Saturday Night Live, which came out in, I think, 1977, it just meant that there would be, like, disco went completely stratospheric, and there would be radio shows across America that were entirely dedicated to disco. So of course you were going to get a backlash. So then a couple of years later, you get the Disco Demolition Night, which, you know, I definitely think there's sort of homophobic, racialized element to that.
That's where a DJ basically organized for a heap of people to bring their disco records and what set them all on fire, was it? Or destroyed them?
Exactly. Yeah. Yes, yes, yes. And he said, and the radio DJ, you know, in fairness to him, he said, no, it was nothing about kind of like homophobia and racism. I just really, really hate disco music. But yeah, it was just pumped out across the radio stations, and it was going to face a backlash. And I think what was interesting is by the end of the decade, it was being critiqued by both the left and the right. So the right would say, you know, oh, it's this sort of ethically dubious message of self-love, you know, it's kind of narcissistic music. And then on the left, people were criticizing it for being kind of too capitalistic, the sort of McDonald's of music. It hit a certain point and got a little bit stuck, but very, very different to the origins of disco, which were very, very eclectic within these dance spaces for marginalized communities in New York and Chicago.
Imogen Willits is here with us, party historian. Now, if we talk about Studio 54 in New York, a lot of people will have heard of it. How did that rise to become a kind of cultural phenomenon that it's remembered as?
So I think the great thing about Studio 54, and similarities as well with the Moulin Rouge, you know, another world famous nightclub environment, is that Studio 54, which opens at the end of the 70s, was an amalgamation of all of the best stuff, you know, all of the experimentation, the crazy experimentation that had happened over the previous sort of 15 years. So you have like Andy Warhol and his, to be honest, like pretty unwatchable, electric light shows, which were, you know, pretty obtuse things, but experimenting with like large scale lighting effects. And then you had Max's Kansas City, this incredible bar that was, in New York, where this amazing congregation mix of people would come. So like high society with the sort of down and outs, with, you know, rock stars, with ordinary people. And it was just this completely extraordinary place. And Studio 54 kind of, yeah, amalgamated all of the best of what had gone before. But I think as well, as I talk about in the book, I think part of, you know, you can't talk about Studio 54 and its rise to popularity without that photo of Bianca Jagger on the white horse, that was, I think, taken very soon after Studio 54 opened, plastered across, you know, newspapers all over the world the following day. And I think that image, it just sort of captures something that we all connect with, because it's just so absurd, it's so decadent, it's kind of fantasy, you know, there's something of the princess fairy tale kind of in it as well, that once that photo had been circulated, everyone wanted to be at Studio 54. And the door policy again was part of the excitement of it, because it was just so unpredictable. They would make a big thing about turning away the occasional celebrity, sometimes urban myth, sometimes it did actually happen, and have this mix of people inside, and no phones, very importantly. So you would have celebrities dancing with ordinary people in this really uninhibited way that had never really happened before.
So just remind me, what was the story with the horse and Bianca Jagger, and why that horse was in there in the first place?
Yes, so it was for her 30th birthday party. And I mean, there was all kinds of crazy stuff that that would happen at Studio 54. Like, it wasn't the first live animal to be kind of probably not great for animal rights, but it was for her 30th birthday. I think they had sort of built some farm sort of theme environment. And she, yeah, was asked to just get on the horse. So she didn't arrive on a white horse. I think that's part of the kind of urban myth, but was asked to just kind of get up and ride it for a little bit. And that was captured in a photograph. And then that was circulated everywhere.
And just on that door policy, I think this is a quote from Andy Warhol, who once said it was a dictatorship at the door and a democracy on the floor, which is very nice. Yeah. So
exactly,
what do you think, Imogen, are the essential elements to a big night out? I mean, lighting's key, isn't it?
Yes, definitely. So you need to be, I think for a big night out, you want something that's kind of unexpected. Yeah, you need to be in a space that's got great music, great lighting, and that there's a sense of unpredictability to it as well. And I think that while nightlife, you know, yes, they're getting dressed up and dancing and music, that side of things is really, really important. I also think nightlife is a space where you can meet interesting people and have quite wild and esoteric conversations that maybe couldn't happen at any other time. And so I think that also the kind of conversational element of nightlife, I think, is also really important. And that's something that I talk about in the Paris in the 1920s chapter. I think what made Paris so magical at that time was that people were just meeting each other and staying up all night in these cafes and just having these sprawling conversations. So I think a night out, if you can get those two things, if you can get some, you know, esoteric conversations with a great dance floor, you're in the right place.
Now, if we go a bit further back in history, though, Imogen, I mean, how did the introduction of street lighting actually open up the possibilities of the night?
Yes, so that was, this huge change that sort of around the 1880s, 1890s in Paris. But what was so interesting about that is that the most avant-garde artists at the time, what that did was it made them actually yearn for a kind of medieval Gothic past. So the artists in Paris then started to take over Montmartre, which was this hilly, underdeveloped wilderness, absolutely not lit by any street lighting at that point. And that's where they were opening up their cabarets as an intentional rejection of modernity, technology, the idea of progress. Like, they wanted nothing to do with the sort of looming 21st century. They just wanted to party in this like decaying pseudo Gothic kind of wasteland. So I think that what's interesting is when you have these big changes within technology, you can also, you know, very much get a backlash from it. And the avant-garde artists in Paris wanted darkness and the Gothic at a time when street lighting was first being introduced.
Yeah. Imogen Willits is a party historian, author of Up All Night. You're on Nightlife with Suzanne Hill here on ABC Radio on this Saturday night. Let's talk about booze before I let you go, Imogen. I mean, how crucial has alcohol been historically to having a big night out?
It is, yeah, it has historically been a, you know, pretty fundamental part of it. So, yeah, I mean, people were getting incredibly drunk at in Vauxhall Gardens, Joshua as well. And, you know, prohibition, you know, that the decade or so that existed in America, you know, people were drinking possibly even more than they were beforehand because of the speakeasy scene, you know, created these amazing places that felt rebellious, and you'd be drinking this like slightly dodgy moonshine home brewed beer or whatever it was. So yes, I think drinking has been part of the way in which we kind of let loose, and to an extent kind of drugs again comes in a little bit later on in the rave scene, the techno scene, even though that wasn't part of the scene at all from the beginning. It was about the kind of euphoria solely of dancing to this kind of music, and the kind of ecstasy stuff came in a bit later in the 90s. So I do think that historically drinking has been important, but I also think you can still have a pretty good night out without that stuff. You know, as I was saying about the techno movement, when that began in the late 80s in Detroit and these kids were dancing at this club called the Music Institute, there was no drinking and there was no drugs, and the experience was purely about dancing. So yeah, you can still have an amazing nightlife scene without that being the focus.
Imogen, we do know that a lot of people are moving away from drinking, especially binge drinking, which, you know, it's there are plenty of health reasons to do that. But do you see that impacting nightlife at the moment?
Yes, because I think at the moment we have, you know, Gen Z who are drinking less and also going out less, and that those things are sort of wrapped up with one another. But that needn't be the case. You know, I think that if generations are thinking more critically about binge drinking, which, you know, from a health perspective, that's a very important, that's a great thing. That I think that if you're kind of being a bit more intentional with how you drink, maybe you're not drinking at all, maybe you're drinking just like a small amount of alcohol, but you're still going out, you know, I think that that's really important. And that's something which we're not necessarily seeing in the main with Gen Z, because they're rejecting, you know, nightclub culture and booze together. And that needn't be the case.
So what hope do you have then for the next generation to revive nightlife? I mean, do you think it's in danger?
So nightlife is in a very difficult place at the moment because, you know, all across the West, like clubs and bars and pubs are closing at a record rate. You know, it is pretty worrying. But I remain optimistic about the future. And I remain optimistic about the future because my hopes are with Gen Alpha. And I think, you know, they're the generation which are sort of kids and preteens now. And when they come of age, they will have an entirely different relationship to phone culture in comparison to Gen Z and millennials that came before them. I think it's very likely that for Gen Alpha, phones will be associated with kind of old people. You know, they will have grown up seeing their parents distracted, scrolling, maybe even their grandparents, you know, distracted and scrolling. So I think that once phone culture is associated with something that old people do, I think that that will create the most incredible opportunity for nightlife. And I think that they will be the generation to move it forward and to give us, you know, the rave movement of the 21st century, like the nightclub of the 21st century. Like we need innovation, we need something new. And I think that Gen Alpha will be the generation to do that.
And then we have to hope that they'll let us old fogies in, won't we?
Exactly. I know. Yes, exactly.
All right. So, and Imogen, do you think London, you know, is London suffering from this kind of closure of pubs and clubs? When you look around, you know, in your home city, is that what you see?
Yes. I mean, and to be honest, yeah, there is still great nightlife. Of course there is in London. And I think that a lot of the most like creative stuff is very much happening in kind of like peripheral scenes in these small, you know, nightclubs or club nights that might exist. You know, Lost, for example, this really cool space, didn't allow phones. Charlie XCX, who partied there a couple of times. But I think what I want to see is that momentum build into a bigger, broader movement rather than just these incredible sort of one-off things that might happen. So that's what we want to see. We want to see more of a movement of new nightlife rather than these, you know, little amazing sort of peripheral experiments that happen kind of on the margins.
Well, Imogen, here is to parties, past, present and future. And thank you so much for being with us here on Nightlife to talk about nightlife.
Thank you so much for having me.
Imogen Willits is a party historian and her book is Up All Night.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.